Good afternoon, and thank you for tuning into our podcast, Hot Topics for Retirement Plan Sponsors. In today's session, I will be speaking with Marina Edwards. Marina joined Invesco in January of 2020 as a senior defined contribution strategist. She has had a 30-year career focused on ERISA compliance and fiduciary risk mitigation. Her areas of specialization include plan governance, compliance, fiduciary training, vendor search, and plan benchmarking. And I'm Bruce Lanzer, a senior retirement plan consultant with UBS, and have nearly 40 years experience working with retirement plan fiduciaries to maximize their fiduciary protection, as well as helping their employees achieve their financial goals and prepare for retirement. Our topic for today is ERISA litigation. The best defense is a good offense. So thank you for joining us this afternoon, Marina, and I'm anxious to hear your thoughts.
It's been amazing, the outburst that we've seen in the 401k market with the number of lawsuits that are happening to corporate and organization 401k and 403b plans. So we kind of wanted to crack open this topic and go a little bit deeper. How are the plaintiff's attorneys targeting their different employers that they're going after? And so we thought we would spend a little bit of time with your audience today just understanding that a little bit deeper. So as we get started, it's very helpful to lay a basis or a foundation for the fiduciary responsibility over these 401k plans. The primary fiduciary responsibility is to discharge his or her duties solely in the interest of participants and their beneficiaries. So when we think about this, and you'll hear this as an underlying theme through the lawsuits that we're going to be talking about today, is we have to be cognizant in thinking about, is this for the exclusive benefit of the participants or the employees of the organization? So we'll hear this as a common theme. One of the most important aspects or tasks, I should say, that fiduciaries need to be thinking about is having a process for overseeing their plan and their administration, documenting their process, and then following that. So it's more about the process and this documentation to the plan and less about the outcome. So, for example, if there's a plan that gets sued for having excessive 401k plan fees, they're going to need to show documentation and proof that they have been paying attention to the fees in the plan and having a process that they have followed and the documentation that follows that process. So this documentation is going to be really important as part of your defense in the event of a 401k lawsuit. It's also important as a backdrop just to be aware that as fiduciaries to these 401k plans, the plan sponsors do have civil liability and criminal liability at stake if they get the fiduciary piece wrong. So fiduciary training on an annual basis, it's a really good idea, and to have that documented. These are the topics that we covered. Here's who attended the fiduciary training, and get that in writing into the files to, again, show that as a fiduciary that you're not asleep at the wheel. We also wanted to talk about some often overlooked fiduciary duties when selecting and monitoring vendors to the 401k plan. So I think about fiduciary responsibility as bookends. So the first bookend is at the very beginning of a service provider engagement, where you're going to need to do an RFP and a service provider review to take your current provider out to bid and, you know, have a couple comparator service providers and bump up against your current provider. And then you use that opportunity to get fresh pricing bids, fresh service ideas, and so forth. So that duty to do an RFP in the selection of your service providers is a fiduciary duty. So that's that first bookend, again, at the beginning of that service provider engagement. The second bookend or the second piece of that fiduciary component is the duty then to monitor that selected service provider. And I will share with you a little bit of a spoiler alert. Many of the lawsuits that are starting to crop up are poking holes in attacking the failure to do these two bookends. So the failure to do an RFP on your fiduciary selection of your providers, or failure to monitor your selected service providers. So I want you to be very thoughtful about these bookends and making sure that you've got the selection and RFP process and the ongoing monitoring in place for each service provider. So it can be an area of concern or question. What all service providers do we need to be thinking about? So I'll give you a list that some of these might actually come as a surprise to some of our listeners. The first one is pretty obvious, your 401k record keeper and trustee. So most all know that if you're going to be selecting a record keeper, you've got to do an RFP. So most are thoughtful about that fiduciary task, that open first bookend. The second one, though, that is sometimes overlooked and is beginning to be targeted in the lawsuits is the duty to do an RFP on your managed account provider or an advice service that your participants use in conjunction with your 401k plan. So many practitioners will say, well, geez, our record keeper only has one managed account or one advice provider that's available to us. So there's really nothing to select because that's our only choice. Well, keep in mind, there's nothing in ERISA that gives us a free pass to not do that first bookend, that RFP, just because there's only one solution that is available. And again, we have to think about what if that one solution that's available is not for the exclusive benefit of the participants? What if we found that when we bumped it up against some competitor service providers, their pricing was really quite high? So you have to be very careful about that and make sure that you're doing that additional RFP, even if there's only one particular service provider that is offered. Two other ones that I'll just mention quickly is, again, often overlooked, the self-directed brokerage window that may be attached to the 401k plan as a feature of your program. The selection of that self-directed brokerage provider is also a fiduciary duty. So you've got to have those bookends, right? The RFP at the beginning, and then the duty to monitor at least on an annual basis. And then the final one that I wanted to comment on, Bruce, is the auto IRA cash outs. So some plans will have, you know, $5,000 account balance. When a participant leaves, that'll automatically be swept into an IRA for that participant. That IRA provider, because it's an automated process of the account balance transferring to the IRA, that selection of the IRA provider is also a fiduciary function. Again, it's going to need the two bookends, the RFP to select and then the monitoring on an ongoing basis.
That's interesting because I don't think most plan sponsors think of evaluating the auto IRA provider and especially the self-directed platform if they're offering that. Let me ask you too, Marina. We've seen a lot of consolidation in the record-keeping industry. In April of 2022, Empower closed on the acquisition of Prudential Retirement. What should plan sponsors do when there's a transaction like that and their service providers, in essence, change, even if the people they're dealing with may not?
Right. It's a great question, and it's one that many plan sponsors have been faced with, as you mentioned, because there has been a lot of consolidation in the industry. So think about that first bookend where you've done your RFP and your selection of your current service provider, and you've understood their financials and their litigation history and their service complaints or their service awards. So you've done good due diligence on that. But when that record keeper sells to another, so we have a new owner, there's logical that you would need to do due diligence on that new owner. So you would want to do an RFP to understand the new acquiring record keeper's service capabilities and the same types of, you know, data elements that you would evaluate for just a normal record keeper. So you got to kind of do a refresh. There's kind of like two thoughts that many plan sponsors will go through, which is, well, if our plan has to convert out of one record keeping platform to another, data is going to be lifted and moved onto a new system. Let's make sure that where the data is moving to is the right selection. So it can be an ideal time to do an RFP and just make sure before the plan is lifted off of the old platform and onto the new one, let's make sure that the new platform is truly the goal and the benefit for the participants.
Okay, so it's best to do it before the transfer comes, but not necessarily right when the transaction is announced.
Yeah. Usually, I mean, when a transaction is announced, there's, you know, anywhere from a year and a half business planning on when they will cadence the transition of the plans. They don't lift them and move them all at once. They'll section them off into, you know, 5-10 different tranches. And, you know, you can kind of negotiate which tranche you're in before the conversion would happen. But that would give you time to do that RFP.
That's good advice. Now, what about some of the litigation that's been going on? What can we learn from these lawsuits?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I want to give you an overview of some of these are oldies, some of oldies but goodies, and some of them are more recent. So let's go through some of the lessons learned that we've seen. And I picked out these particular cases because the topics of the lesson are very relevant to some of the current lawsuits that are happening. So let's start by just doing a quick recap of the Hughes versus Northwestern case. And this is a Supreme Court case. It was for the Northwestern University 403B plans, sued by Schlichter, taken to the Supreme Court. And Judge Sotomayor, in her opinion, she stated that the duty of prudence for these fiduciaries involves this continuing duty to monitor all. And I'm going to stress the word all because I'm going to come back and comment on that. It involves a continuing duty to monitor all plan investments and remove the imprudent ones within a reasonable time. So this is a message that we've heard before. We actually heard this same similar message in Tibble v. Edison some 5 or 6 years ago. This ongoing duty to monitor is the key lesson. And remember, that's that second bookend. We've heard it. It's been reinforced now by two Supreme Court cases, both of them tried successfully by Schlichter. So again, it hammers home, we have this ongoing duty to monitor. But I want to revisit that special word, all. When Judge Sotomayor said, have a duty to monitor all plan investments, there's many practitioners in the industry that are taking the literal interpretation of the word all. Because if we're thoughtful about it, could it be construed to mean that we need to monitor the assets inside the self-directed brokerage account? And I know that is a little bit breathtaking for many of us because we've seen and successfully that if you have a self-directed brokerage feature in your plan, you need to do the selection of the brokerage provider. But you do not have any fiduciary responsibility or oversight for the investments that are selected inside that self-directed brokerage window by your plan participants. So when Judge Sotomayor says a continuing duty to monitor all plan investments, we get a little nervous that that might mean that the Department of Labor could be coming forth with additional clarification or guidance on the definition of that word all. I'll piggyback that comment with the fact that the Department of Labor right now has established a task force, if you will, an ERISA advisory council, to take on the topic of self-directed brokerage and whether or not the assets inside the brokerage windows should be required to be monitored by plan fiduciaries or not. Another case that I'd like to talk just briefly about is George v. Kraft. And this was one of the earlier excessive fee cases. But it was interesting in this case because their record keeper came forward and proactively provided Kraft with a lower participant fee. So Kraft naturally said, well, this looks great. Thank you. It's a significant savings off of what we were paying. We'll put it in place, send out our required communications to the plan participants. And they got pinched on this because they did not RFP that new voluntary lower price that their record keeper gave them. Because the challenge was, well, you know, your record keeper gave you a lower fee, but how do you know that that was low enough? How do you know? So knowing that we need to be operating for the exclusive benefit of our plan participants, we need to be checking, is that number a good number? And because Kraft had not benchmarked that offer by their record keeper, this was one little nuance that they got pinched on. So just because you're working with your record keeper and you feel like they're doing something great for you by giving you this nice fee reduction, keep in mind, you've got to be doing that double check. Another one that I want to talk just a little bit about, which goes to the self-directed brokerage, is another older excessive fee case called Hecker versus Deere. And what's interesting about Hecker versus Deere was the participants were claiming, saying there's way too many proprietary funds. And when I mean proprietary, I mean funds that are the same as the record keeper. There's way too many proprietary funds in our lineup. And surely that can't be for the exclusive benefit of us participants. And when the judge was weighing this, he came back and actually said, ladies and gentlemen, participants, you do have access to a self-directed brokerage account where you can go get, you know, any of the funds that you're looking for. So in essence, the fact that Deere had the self-directed brokerage was a little bit of their, what I would call like the get out of jail free card on that complaint, because the plan did offer self-directed brokerage. So when you hear this particular case on the heels of the Northwestern case of whether, you know, plan assets inside brokerage needs to be monitored, but then the courts here are saying, well, if you've got brokerage, it's great because, you know, you can't be, I don't want to say can't, but you can't be found guilty of a lineup that's, you know, all proprietary funds. So it is a little bit of a back and forth and a pro and con on brokerage right now.
So it sounds like the judge said you can invest in non-proprietary because you have a self-directed account. It seems like if they didn't have that, having only the proprietary or a preponderance of proprietary funds would have been an issue.
Yes, I think you're right. And we have seen that exact complaint, Bruce, mm-hmm. crop up in other lawsuits. And in particular, if they are proprietary funds to your record keeper, and I'm going to draw a distinction. What if you had, and I'll just use an example, like what if you had all Fidelity index funds in your lineup, but your record keeper was Vanguard? Would that be a problem? Well, probably not, because Vanguard, your record keeper, is not collecting inherent benefits or value and revenue from offering proprietary funds. But if you've got all Fidelity funds and Fidelity is your record keeper in this example, you better be very careful and have documentation and a process for making sure that those proprietary funds are truly for the exclusive benefit of those plan participants.
I was going to say that as an investment consultant too, it's highly unlikely, and I've never seen it happen in my career, that when I'm doing an analysis and search for funds in a number of different asset classes for a plan, that the same firm is going to be the best choice in multiple asset classes.
Right. Yeah, we see the same thing. That's right. Yeah, we like to see a variety. We like to see a full bouquet and bloom of different investment funds. Another one that I wanted to highlight for you is Barnett versus Alight. And this is actually one where it was Barnett versus Abbott Labs. But we'll talk about this. Abbott Labs was actually dismissed from the lawsuit. So the topic on this one is one that's kind of near and dear to my heart. It's cyber and fraud and the hacking that is beginning to happen inside our 401k plans. And I say near and dear to my heart only because it's a new topic and we are really trying to be waving our arms to plan sponsors and participants to raise awareness to each of us as individuals that our 401k plans are not as safe as we might think that they are, just because the cyber technology and hackers are really, really honing in on these big buckets of money in the 401k plans. So Barnett versus Abbott Labs and Alight. So in this case, one of the Abbott Labs plan participants had money that went missing from their 401k account of no fault of their own. So their account was hacked into, money was missing, and then the participant was saying, somebody needs to make me whole. Because the participant said, I didn't take it. When, of course, the plan sponsor says, well, we didn't, it's not our fault, we didn't do it. And the record keeper says, well, it wasn't our fault, we didn't do it. So there's all this finger pointing. So the participant brings suit and sues the employer, the fiduciary committee, and the record keeper. And as part of the discovery process, they were able to uncover that the Abbott Labs fiduciary committee did have documentation. Remember, I'm going to go back to process and documentation. So Abbott Labs did have that process in place and documentation that they were aware of this cyber and fraud developing issue, and they were taking action on it. So they had good fiduciary processes in place that they were following. As a result of that good behavior, they were excused from the lawsuit. So the lawsuit is still open with Barnett versus Alight, the record keeper. So the key message out of the Barnett versus Alight or Abbott Labs lawsuit is that we need to be making sure that as plan sponsors, we are paying attention to the fiduciary issues within the plan and notifying the plan participants. The Department of Labor has come forth last year and gave us three different PDFs of guidance as plan sponsors and fiduciaries on how to tackle this new topic. So the first PDF is about you as a plan sponsor and the fiduciary steps you should take to make sure that your cyber practices are buttoned up. The second PDF talks about service provider agreements and things that you should be looking for with your service providers. Third PDF that the DOL provided is on how to communicate these topics to your plan participants and including a sample letter and communication. So the fact that the Department of Labor is focusing on this very bright new topic, it's kind of a call to action for all of us that it's an area that we need to shore up in our fiduciary files.
The interesting thing about cases like Barnett versus Alight and the DOL's guidance and PDFs, as you said, related to cybersecurity, that many times the fraud is just very low tech. Somebody duplicated passwords or a person called into a phone center and convinced the other person on the line that they were the individual and somehow released the funds just in a very low tech manner.
That's right. And in fact, that I think we've all probably experienced a call center where we've called in, whether it's your cell phone service company or whatnot, where they're asking you to self-authenticate. Can you give me your date of birth? Can you give me your mailing address, including zip code? And if the hackers have this information, they are able to self-authenticate as if they were you. And then they're off to the races for setting up, you know, their banking information over the phone through the call center, initiating the wire, $25 wire fee, no problem. Just send it overnight. Okay. Wire goes out. The account gets closed the next day and the money's gone. Mm-hmm.
We always need to be vigilant.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I think about too, Bruce, is for each one of us, our 401k accounts, for many of us, are one of our largest assets, if not the largest asset. And we do expect safekeeping and security over that. But again, these hackers are finding new creative ways to get into it. And for us as individuals and our own participants in our own plans, we aren't necessarily thinking that those retirement accounts could be hacked into. Exactly. That's top of mind for our checking accounts because we've heard about that. We've heard people using credit card fraud, but it's not top of mind for us to be thinking about 401ks. So one of the asks that I would like to put out to the audience is encourage your friends, family, participants, those around you, individuals, go run a report out of your own 401k account for the last 12 months or as far back as you can and look for any unauthorized withdrawals or distributions. We need to be doing a better job ourselves of keeping an eye on our own accounts and looking for those fraudulent withdrawals.
Exactly.
One other lawsuit that I want to kind of close with before we would talk about some of the other key fiduciary points is a newer lawsuit called Reichert versus Juniper. And this one's got five really interesting complaints that I want to just narrate for our audience, Bruce. Mm-hmm. The first complaint that they came forward with is unreasonable record-keeping fees. And they said, you haven't done an RFP. So, you know, it was over 10 years since you've done the last RFP. So how do you know that the fees that you're paying are adequate? They were using Schedule C 5500 data on plan administration costs. And we don't know all that goes into that administrative fee line, but they're taking that fee line and dividing it by the number of participants and coming up with a plan fee per participant. They then go find 16 other 5500s and look for comparable size and, you know, size of plans. You can't tell the complexity of a plan based on the 5500, but these attorneys are trying. And they're doing that similar math and they're kind of cherry picking. And of course, so you could find the right data set the longer that you look. So they found 16 different comparator plans derived from the Form 5500s and calculated their fees and then made the allegation that Juniper Networks plan fees were way high. And again, in my opinion, I think it's probably, you know, a data accumulation issue. The second complaint that they had was that there's unreasonable and expensive share classes. And this is an interesting complaint because they said the plan sponsor did not consider index funds over actively managed funds. So the Juniper Networks plan lineup has got a number of actively managed funds. And they said, show me that you actually considered index funds and why did you pick active over index? Well, there's nothing in ERISA that says that we need to use active or we need to use index. So what do we need to do? We need to go back to process, and the documentation. What does our investment policy say on this particular topic? So again, if they've got good documentation on why they were selecting these actively managed funds, they should be able to be in good shape for that. The other thing that they did, though, to kind of grab the attention of the reader of this complaint was they took the investment lineup expense ratios of all of the funds, of these actively managed funds, and they said instead of using the actively managed fund for the like small cap growth fund, you should have been using the index fund, you know, the comparable index. And they did this for each one of the actively managed funds, stating you should have been in the index. And they calculated the delta between the actively managed expense ratio and the index expense ratio, and then chained the math, like the cost of those excessive fees over the past 5 years. And they put a number in the lawsuit complaint that there is damage to plan participants of $22 million. So that's pretty hard to ignore when you're seeing damage to participants of $22 million. Again, but they're saying that the prudent investment should have been the index. Well, again, you've got to go back to the plan's investment policy statement and the committee policies on these types of things instead of just making these broad allegations. The other notion that came with the unreasonable expensive share class complaint has to do with revenue sharing rebates. And they're basically, the complaint was you were in a nice low share class investment. Let's just use the example of, you know, a fund that's like an R6 share class with 79 basis points. And the complaint was, instead of being in a 79 basis point fund with no revenue sharing, you should have picked the more prudent investment, which would have been a more expensive share class with 113 basis points that has a 50 basis point revenue sharing credit that can be given back to participants. And when that 50 basis point revenue credit is netted against the 113 basis point expense ratio, the net investment expense to the participants would be 63 basis points instead of the R6 at 79 basis points. Now, I know that sounded a little bit confusing, but maybe your readers might need to rewind that. But the key thing here is the allegation was you should have been in the more expensive share class and capturing the revenue sharing and rebating that to participants. But I'll tell you, as a practitioner, Bruce, that's a lot of gymnastics and gyrations and math for the record keeper to have to go through to get back an imprecise revenue credit to plan participants. Again, this would be a great task to have documented that the plan will use only non-revenue sharing funds, or when revenue sharing is going to be used, it'll always be lower than the R6 version. So there's ways that you could structure to eliminate this. But this will be an interesting one to watch.
That's right, because sometimes there are funds, as you were pointing out, that the net cost after the revenue sharing is less than the share class without any revenue sharing.
Right. Well, and the question of which do you use, it would go back to what is your process? You've got a process around this particular, you know, issue. What's the process? And then follow it and then document that you're following the process. And that, again, goes back to that opening comments that we were saying. That's more important than many times than the actual outcome of the decision. Right. The other area, the third area that we're seeing with this particular lawsuit is a claim against managed accounts. And the complaint is that managed accounts offer little to no value to plan participants. Okay, so defend that. So we want to say, yes, it actually does offer value to participants. Okay, prove it. What documentation do you have in your files? Maybe your monitoring documentation. What do you have that shows that your plan participants using your managed account provider are better off than those that are not? be thoughtful if you're not able to answer that question, because again, that's being alleged as you know, part of this complaint. They're also saying that the fees for that managed account are really expensive. So 60 basis points. That's just a really expensive target date fund is the claim. There's another component to it, which is back to the bookends. They said there's a failure to do the RFP. And of course, because there's no RFP, you're paying high fees. So this, you know, added claim of breach of fiduciary duty for no RFP, and it's probably one of those instances where there's only one managed account solution that's offered on the record keeping platform, and one of those opening comments that we shared. The fourth complaint with this one that's just interesting is the failure to fully disclose fees and performance. And they were saying that the 404A5 fee disclosure was incomplete and inaccurate. Now, the duty to ensure that these disclosures are complete and accurate resides with the plan sponsor. So that's the buck stops there with them. So when you get these fee disclosures from your service providers, if you're not reviewing them and making sure that they're not only accurate, but they're complete and not missing information is really important. Again, because it's showing up as a fiduciary breach when those disclosures are wrong.
Even though your record keeper is the one probably sending out the disclosures, the ultimate responsibility goes back to the plan sponsor to make sure it's complete and accurate.
Yep. And it's the plan sponsor that's the fiduciary on the plan. So then the granddaddy, the fifth claim on this particular case was there's a failure to monitor your fiduciaries. And the complaint was saying, if you've got these other four major complaints that are happening in your plan, clearly your board of directors has failed to monitor the fiduciary committee that they have appointed. And so we think about defending that. So you're going to have to show that you did keep the board informed, that the fiduciary committee steps and processes were acknowledged by the board. So the board needs to be doing their monitoring of their delegation of the fiduciary duties down to the fiduciary committee. So again, we like to see on an annual basis, at least that fiduciary committee create a 1 or 2 page summary. These are the things that the 401k plan committee did this last year. We did an RFP, we did the benchmarking or whatever it might be. You know, we negotiated the fees, we added funds, so forth, and provide that 2-page executive summary to the board of directors. The board chalks those in one of their director meetings and gets into the minutes. And again, that duty to monitor is then documented. So maybe we'll take a little bit of a path change and cover some interesting ideas that we can use as fiduciaries to help mitigate some of these lawsuits that are cropping up. So we've put together a 35-point checklist that plan sponsors can use kind of as a, they cover many of the things that we've talked about today, but there's a number of other interesting ideas that are included in this checklist. We've taken the checklist and broken it down into a couple different sections. So there's a section on governance, another section on investments, section on plan fees, plan documentation, plan administration, and plan communications. So I know, Bruce, you've got copies of that. Right. So let's go through a couple different areas of maybe in each of these different categories of some of these key lessons learned. So let's start with governance. First one that we want to think about is to actually create a governance charter document that outlines the fiduciary delegation from the board down to the fiduciary committee. There should be a formal acceptance of the fiduciary members, acknowledging their role as a fiduciary, understanding their roles and responsibilities. There should be training that is done for those fiduciaries. And then that monitoring process, the board should have a monitoring process in place to monitor that delegated fiduciary committee. So a good governance charter would help provide that kind of that skeletal structure to the organization. Another area in governance, which is kind of we get a lot of questions on this, is, you know, how often should we do benchmarking? How often should we do a full RFP? And ERISA doesn't give us any clear guidance on this, but they just say that you need to be operating for the exclusive benefit of the plan participants. So the general rule of thumb that's been adopted in the industry is you take the plan out to bid with a formal RFP every 5 to 6 years, whether the plan needs it or not. You could have an amazing service team and great plan participant outcomes and great statistics. Even though the plan is running like a well-oiled machine, you still need to be going through this RFP process every 5 to 6 years to show good fiduciary due diligence for those plan participants. And again, that's that first bookend of doing the RFP and selection. Then in the middle of that 5 to 6 year period, so somewhere around year two, year three, you should be doing benchmarking. So fee and service benchmarking and making sure that there's nothing that's happening in the market that you're missing out on, whether it's fee compression or really cool new services that are being, you know, they're cropping up by the record keepers. So doing a fee and service benchmarking every 2 to 3 years is usually prudent. You know, there's a lot of practitioners that like to do fee benchmarking every single year. And in my opinion, that's just a little bit overkill unless the, you know, the plan demographics have changed quite a bit. The other area that we're seeing as a new idea for mitigating some of these lawsuits is to actually partner with your auditing firm, right? We know that the 401k plans get audited every year. What if you could ask your auditor to include a fiduciary governance paragraph as part of their annual audit report that simply states some of these key plan statistics? For example, the last time we took the plan out to bid was in 2018. The last time we did fee benchmarking for fees and service was in 2022. We changed investments to the lowest share class this last year. The plan has a practice of paying for the record keeping fees, you know, charging it back to each participant on a per head basis. What you're doing is you're actually showcasing, without a lot of detail, you're showcasing some of the fiduciary process that is happening inside the plan for the plaintiff's attorney's eyes to see. We know that they are using these 5,500 filings as the basis for where they're coming up with what they think or suspect is a plan that might have fiduciaries that are asleep at the wheel. So in the audit, which is what they're combing through, what if we could help and showcase our due diligence by saying, you know, these are some of the best practices. Don't sue us on these areas because we've already got them all buttoned up. So again, work with outside counsel to, you know, formulate what that language should look like. Ask if your auditing firm can include this, but I think it would be a very helpful defensive mechanism for plan sponsors.
I think you're right. And I'm not aware of any audit firms that are doing that as part of their regular annual audit.
Right. Well, you know, the one thing we've heard too, Bruce, is that the auditing firms are beginning to ask questions to the plan sponsors about some of the dates and topics that we've just rattled off. So if the auditors are asking for this information, can they take it and distill it down into a paragraph that would be helpful and not harmful to the plan sponsor? Insurance underwriters are also beginning to do these questionnaires. You know, I've seen there's a 10 question questionnaire that's been flying around from the insurance underwriters asking these same types of questions. When was the last time you did an RFP? What was the result of that RFP? Did you change record keepers? Did you negotiate lower fees? Do you have any funds that have revenue sharing? If yes, how is the revenue sharing handled? Is it used to pay for plan fees? Is it credited back to plan participants? If it's credited back to plan participants, how is that done and how often? I mean, you can see and hear the detail that they're looking for. My fear is if plan sponsors are filling out that questionnaire and sending it back to their auditors or to the insurance underwriters, they could be creating a smoking gun and a paper trail that could come back to bite them if the answers to those questions could be damaging. So just think about that, right? You're sending something in email and you're not thinking twice about it because of course you're going to be, you know, complying with your insurance underwriting timing requests and your audit underwriting timing requests. But in doing so, we might be leaving some really dangerous breadcrumbs for attorneys to pick up if there was a lawsuit. So what would you do? Well, we would recommend just making a phone call to your ERISA attorney and asking if you can get that type of documentation under attorney-client privilege and sending it to the insurance and auditing underwriting departments that way.
Any final thoughts, Marina, before we close this session?
I know we're getting a little bit close on time here, Bruce. I've certainly appreciated the time to spend with you and share some of these thoughts with your audience. I would just say, again, for plan sponsors, the 401k is a really important benefit, and it's one that participants need, they really value, and it's up to us as fiduciaries to be good stewards of those dollars. And we know it's a little bit of a mousetrap landscape that we're walking through, but again, if we're keeping our eyes open and learning to navigate it, I think we can do it as a team.
Thank you very much for your time, Marina, and I'm sure our listeners learned a lot from your points. And if anyone would like to receive a copy of the 35-point fiduciary considerations checklist that Marina mentioned, you can reach out to me, Bruce Lanzer, at 414-289-3817. Again, that's 414-289-3817. Or email me at Bruce, B-R-U-C-E, Lanzer, L-A-N-S-E-R, at UBS.com. Thank you for listening and stay tuned for further podcasts.